Welcome to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational, always amusing conversations about movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics production hosted by myself, Johnny DiLoretto, and John DeSando. This is Double Take.
Double Take. Well, I'm telling you, I took more than a double take.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. You go.
Yeah, no, I'm real excited about this conversation. Because you've finally seen one of my favorite films that I can't believe you've never seen.
And I can't either. And I thought for sure 30 years ago I saw it, and I didn't. And it's called Midnight Run. And it's with one of our favorite actors, Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And everything you said about it, and even more, is true. I was in awe of what a great film it was.
Yeah.
And thought for a moment that I was in a Martin Scorsese film, but then I really isn't.
Yeah, it's directed by Martin Brest, who at the time was best known for Beverly Hills Cop.
Right.
He has since faded into obscurity because he's also the infamous director of the film Gigli. You remember that movie?
Yes.
The one that flopped.
With Jennifer
Lopez and Ben Affleck with an Al Pacino turn.
Ooh.
It was, you know, at the height of their popularity, the Bennifer craze. And this movie came out, and it was widely considered to be maybe one of the worst films ever made.
I know.
And it effectively pretty much stymied Brest's career. I don't know that he's directed anything else again. I'd have to look into that. But, I mean, you can be sure that he's not top-lining any major productions since then. However, this guy has this movie. He's made one of the great films of all time.
Sure.
Certainly, in my opinion, the greatest buddy road movie of all time.
All right. And boy, that's saying a lot when you and I have loved Butch Cassidy.
I know. And I do love Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Mm.
One, because it's a Western. One, because it has two of the great movie star performances
right.
of all time. But I got to tell you, Midnight Run, I have returned to more frequently over the years. I've probably seen Midnight Run upwards of 30 times.
Uh-huh, and I can understand it. And there's great stuff. Somebody was playing for me the other day, the scene where they get the $20 bills.
Yeah, the con
the con, which is
the litmus configuration.
Right, and he starts doing it on the bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I just thought that was a wonderful juxtaposition of two very different characters.
Yeah,
in ingratiating themselves with us, bringing us into that place where they're conning these people out of this money.
Yeah,
and the oddest of circumstances where De Niro's character Jack Walsh is taking Grodin in.
He's taking a back seat to him. I mean, as Jack Walsh, De Niro is taking in the Duke, right? He's bringing him cross country to turn him back into the bail bondsman so he won't forfeit his money.
Right. Which is even funny itself, the Duke, because this guy is an accountant.
Yeah, right.
Although he's smart enough to scoop up millions from Dennis Farina or whatever.
Right, from his Chicago gangster. But it's a great scene because the movie pivots there. De Niro is clearly in charge the whole time, but they run out of money. They need food to eat, so they come up with this con. And De Niro lets Grodin run the show. And it's just an interesting kind of turning point in their friendship in the movie. I did want to ask you, you know, talking about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and, you know, and so many movies since this one. I mean, including like around the same time, 48 Hours movies.
Mm-hmm.
You have, you know, so many buddy movies trade in on the opposite personality traits.
Yes.
Right? What makes this one work? Why does that shtick not tire here?
You know, even when I think about Butch Cassidy and when I think about our girls and, what is it?
Thelma and Louise.
I think that there's a certain yuck element to those where they're going to be pounding us for some laughs about the differences between the two of them.
Yeah.
This one feels so organic to me. I'm not waiting for any laughs. I am just intrigued how these two guys seem to have formed a friendship in the oddest of circumstances. But nothing is played over the top. Nothing. Yeah. Not even De Niro is over the top.
Right, right. That I think is maybe the ace up the movie's sleeve is De Niro's lived-in performance.
Yes.
A lot of times you get, you know, movie stars, big personalities in these roles, and it's flashy. It's there's no substance, right? De Niro is giving this part every bit of his devotion to the craft. You know, he's definitely not sleepwalking through this fun movie. He has invested Jack Walsh with a deep humanity. And it really does, like, he's having fun, but I think it's one of his best top five performances.
Oh yeah, without a doubt.
You
yeah.
agree?
Oh, I agree.
I mean, it is up there, like, you know, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Jack Walsh is one of these parts.
And one of the reasons is for me is that he holds himself in. He restricts his sometimes inclination to go over. And he just mutes himself to allow the combination to come forward. So that, and that's what I'm saying. I'm just so intrigued by their relationship up to the end, which is a marvelous ending, showing the humanity of both of them.
That is a key word, I think, in unlocking the full pleasures of this movie is kind of letting those moments of humanity breathe. We were talking earlier about the scene where Jack and Jonathan show up at De Niro's ex-wife's house in Chicago, right?
Wow.
And he needs money.
Wonderful.
He needs a car.
That's a great scene.
And there's so much interesting stuff happening in that scene. So the ex-wife answers the door. There's definitely a tension there, right? You feel it. You feel that post-divorce kind of lingering trauma there. And yet at the same time, under it, is this little current of mutual kind of care and affection, right? She cares about this guy. And then the daughter steps in, and who he hasn't seen in many, many years, right? And it's a heartbreaking scene when the girl tries to give him her babysitting money.
Yes.
And he cannot take it. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen an action movie, you know, prior to that or post-1988 that has that kind of lived in warmth and humanity to it.
And, you know, there are so many films out, and even superhero films, where the father-daughter motif is prominent. None of them comes close to the subtlety of that scene you're talking about, to where she tries to give him her money.
Yeah.
And he can't take it. And he puts it aside in a way that's I've just never seen. Such subtlety, such love on his part. And her reaction is very, as a great actor will do, pulling her right out as an actress, this little girl.
Yeah.
And wow.
And it leads to me to one of the finest moments in the film. After that exchange, she goes back into the house. He puts the Duke into the car. And Grodin's coat, he's wearing that top coat. It's just the corner of it is hanging out of the car. De Niro picks it up and gently kind of puts it inside the car and taps it back into place on his lap before he shuts the door. At that moment, something has changed between them. The Duke has seen Jack at his most vulnerable. He sees, you know, earlier in the film, Jack says, "I got lots of people who love me." You know, who? These two people, right? These two people, the ex-wife who hates him and the daughter who he hasn't seen. So like that comes full circle. It plays out right there. The Duke has seen all of this. He sees exactly how few people love Jack in his life.
Two things. First of all, how humorous it is that this accountant's name is the Duke.
Yeah.
It comes out of his name. It's just funny. But
we're right. Because he's hoodwinked and swindled this gangster. That's why he's the Duke. He's come out on top.
And do you think, like the scene in Midnight Cowboy, where Pacino hits the front of the car.
You mean
says I'm walking.
Hoffman, Dustin Hoffman.
Hoffman, really.
Yeah.
It hits the. Do you think that the coat is another one of those incidents where you could argue it either just happened that way and they captured it, that moment of humanity where he takes his...
Oh, yeah. I wonder. I mean...
It's conceivable.
Right. It's conceivable. And, you know, that what a genius De Niro is then, yeah. right? If he saw that moment and played that. yeah, great. So much great stuff. What about the chemistry? I wanted to tell you this. There were, and this has been talked about before, so, you know, I don't know if our listener has, you know, trod this ground before, but casting changes.
Yeah.
You know, Charles Grodin, by the way, who is, in my opinion, given two of the great comedy performances, his first great comedy performance is in The Heartbreak Kid in 1971.
Yeah, right.
I love that movie. It is a very dark comedy. But, you know, he was kind of poised to be a big star. It never quite happened.
Right.
He did, he consistently worked with great people in great movies over the years, but never in that kind of a, you know, marquee type.
Didn't
lead.
He start as a comedian? Like stand up?
No, he was an actor. He was an actor. Okay. He actually studied with Dustin Hoffman, now that you mention it, in New York. But they were, you know, he was not the top of anybody's list.
Okay.
They were talking about Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
Could you imagine that?
I can't. And that's the problem with this discussion, is once you see a superior performance such as Grodin's, it's very difficult to put anybody in there.
And it really sort of like, you. I mean, we all know Robin Williams is great, but he would have tipped it.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Tipped the balance of the movie. And that, you know, I'm sure that when Grodin and De Niro... or when Grodin auditioned with De Niro, that chemistry started to become very apparent very quickly.
Yes.
They at one point even entertained casting Cher as the Mardukas character.
Boy, which would have completely changed even the tone of it.
Right. And then, you know, there would have been these romantic overtures or something like that.
Right.
Thank God it happened the way it happened.
Yeah. Now, how about, I mean, we're not ending our discussion, but the ending so intrigues me.
Yeah.
The acts of humanity that both of them perform there seem exceptional to me, and ones that I accept, even though they're a bit outrageous when you consider what each one does, at least what Grodin does for him, for sure.
Yeah.
Right? And then as they leave, doesn't De Niro, is there something warm and brotherly about?
He gives him the watch.
Yes, the watch that doesn't work. That's what I wanted. Exactly. Yes.
As a token to remember our adventure by.
Yes, excellent.
And it's such a beautiful thing. You know, and it's one of those classic kind of things in a movie where, like, there's a little bit of business that's running throughout the movie that you're probably not paying that much attention to, right?
Yes.
And again, it's one of those things that De Niro does so beautifully throughout the movie, is checking this watch, tapping on the watch.
I know.
And it's not working.
Just short of annoying for me.
Yeah.
Enough times.
Right, yeah.
I begin to, because the payoff's worth it.
And then the payoff.
Right.
There is something, you know, I was trying to think before we had this conversation, what makes this movie still relevant? And I can't help but think about the current cultural moment that we're in, where we're all so divided. I mean, in a lot of ways, we're all trapped in a tragic buddy comedy movie, right? Where some people are entrenched and angry, and some people are enlightened and forward thinking. And that's what you have here, really, right? You have this guy who's angry. Jack is an angry dude. He's, you know, he's divorced. He's estranged from the daughter that he loves.
Yeah.
He has been kicked off of the police force in Chicago because he wouldn't, you know, in his mind, he did the right thing. He wouldn't go on the take. So this is a guy who's, as you learn about his backstory, you start to understand his anger, right? So how does he change? I mean, I think we can all learn a little bit from, the movie still feels relevant to me.
Well, their generosity.
And maybe, sorry to interrupt you, but it may be even more relevant now, because now that relationship actually sort of is speaking to something that we're all going through.
Oh, no, I agree. And I would add to that simply by saying that true love of each other in a brotherly way seems to me so modern that the sacrifices that each one makes at the end, the watch and the money.
Yeah.
And it's been about the money. And Grodin just gives it to him. It is a wonderful piece of love between the two of them in the kind of very modern bromance that doesn't have any of any negatives about it. Now, tell me how you see these two up against Midnight Cowboy and Thelma and Louise. You know, how you're talking about maybe this is superior to those?
Well, I mean, you know, Midnight Cowboy is a tragedy.
Yep.
Right? Thelma and Louise you could argue that that's also a tragedy. There are heavier things, and the stakes are higher, I think, in those two films, both dramatically and thematically, you know. Thelma and Louise, you know, that adventure is a whole feminist kind of lens through which the movie kind of examines our culture, mm-hmm. right? Their situation, right? It's a no-win situation. A lot of people had problems with that. A lot of feminists had problems with the ending of Thelma and Louise
because, of course.
But I don't.
No.
I think it's kind of like, it's the final FU of the movie. It's like, you know, sometimes death is the only way to escape oppression, right? You'd rather be free that way. I get it that it's problematic.
And don't you think it's a little more comedic? I mean, if you're talking comedies.
Well, I don't think. I mean, Midnight Run is more comedic.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's what I mean. It comes at you like a comedy. And the humanity is what kind of elevates it. You know, these little currents of humanity and sadness. You know, like I often think of De Niro saying, I just want to get this $100,000 and get out of this miserable effing business forever. There's something about that, the way, the cadence of that line, the way he delivers it, that he can just see this last act of his life.
That's all I want to do is
just
get
escape.
Out of
I can just do this right at a coffee shop. No, something so simple.
I think in a matter of judging buddy films, mm-hmm. I think John Voight and Dustin Hoffman compete very well with Grodin and De Niro here.
In terms of chemistry?
Yeah. And everything you want to say, who's the better team of the two? I don't know, man, because I am really impressed with Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah.
And it is an interesting Midnight Cowboy and Midnight Run.
Yeah, right.
And I see the two of them. We can put Butch Cassidy aside because I think it's a little bit too evenly charming.
Yeah.
You know, but where I get a real difference in characters between De Niro and Grodin, stark difference, where you get and you blend that together into a friendship. But the same thing happens in Midnight Cowboy, but I guess your point is well taken. You got something very serious going on in Midnight Cowboy. It's hard to compare that with the lightness of Midnight Run.
Right. I did want to ask you, and I didn't get a chance to ask you on Cinema Classics, the score. How did you feel about the score of the movie?
You know, I'm very bad to ask me that.
Yeah.
Because I would have to go back. I get so caught up in characterization and dialogue.
Yeah.
It's one of my really weak points.
It's one of my favorite scores.
Good.
And the movie, it comes in real slow. It's got that steel bluesy guitar kind of dun dun dun, you know, like, and for me, I hear that. I hear the first few notes of that, and it ushers me right into the world of that movie in a way that, you know, few movie scores do, right? I think it's an underrated score, but when you and then it like jazzes up, you know, and you get the dun 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 dun, dun, you know, all that fun horn mm-hmm. stuff. Anyway, if you ever revisit.
No, I will. And that's a great question for me. I need to go back to assess the music. But I also wanted to ask you, what about the secondary characters in Midnight Run?
Oh, my God.
Don't you think that's a strength?
Whole tapestry of there's a whole other conversation we could do.
Led by Dennis Farina.
Dennis Farina, yeah.
I mean, just almost a parody. Mm-hmm. Of the mobster,
right? But he's so perpetually angry. But you know what's great? I'm glad you brought that up because we're laughing at this guy, right? Because he's so bombastic. He's threatening. Yes. He's threatening his lawyer every 2 minutes.
Yes.
But at the end, when he captures the Duke, and he has him in the limo.
Yes.
That is a very menacing scene. Suddenly, he's not so funny. And when he says, I'm going to kill you.
Oh, right.
And then I'm going to go.
Great point. Yes.
I'm going to kill your wife.
Right.
And he says it with such icy kind of disdain that suddenly that character is not funny anymore. And we really need to see him go down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think your comment, too, about it being very modern is an important one for people who could now, you know, just come home, hi, honey, let's watch a movie and watch this. Let me see, where are we? It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
And it comes with your subscription. So they could just say, you know, if you're looking around and we've had some not great movies this summer,
right.
You know, don't you think somebody, almost anybody, would enjoy this?
I mean, who wouldn't
enjoy it?
I don't know. You know, I remember it was actually one of the last films I watched with my mom before she passed. And I remember, you know, she had some dementia issues.
Yeah.
And I remember her laughing every time they said the F word. You know, she got a big kick out of that. And they say the F word about 170 sometimes. So she got a big kick out of it.
All right.
Yeah, there you go.
I am so happy. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
For introducing me. Your taste is impeccable.
Time.
I know. And I'm just trying to pass that word on to everybody I know. See Midnight Run.